Manjika, and welcome to A Portrait of Us, an NGV podcast where Australia's art becomes an instigator for holding deeper conversations about life, culture, and the incredible diversity of this country. I'm Brooke Blurton, and in this podcast, I get to talk to some of Australia's most significant artists. Together, we'll delve into how art reflects, challenges, and enriches our perspectives, drawing us closer to one another through dialogue and discovery. Here, art isn't just observed. It's our meeting point, our bridge to connect. In each episode, I speak with artists who embody the experiences and stories that make up Australia today. This podcast is all about celebrating Australian art and its people in its many shapes and forms.
Welcome to A Portrait of Us. My name is Sophie Gerard and I'm Curator of Australian and First Nations Art at the National Gallery of Victoria. Unfortunately, Brooke Blurton is unwell today, so unable to join this episode. But we do have two wonderful guests who will be speaking around the topic of language. With me here, I've got Jazz Money and Catherine Haddam. A bit about Jazz. Jazz was described by Vogue Australia as a multidisciplinary force. With a practice centered in poetics, Jazz produces work across a range of mediums, including visual art, film, performance, audio, and print. Their work has been widely published nationally and internationally and performed on stages around the world, including TEDx Sydney, the Edinburgh International Book Festival, and the Sydney Opera House. Jazz trained as a filmmaker with their first feature film, Wenangana, commissioned by the National Film and Sound Archive. Jazz's first poetry collection, the best-selling How to Make a Basket, won the David Unaipon Award. Their second collection, Mark the Dawn, is out this August and has received the UQP Quentin Bryce Award. Jazz is a proud descendant of the Wiradjuri Nation. Catherine Haddam works across painting, drawing, collage, printmaking, and sculpture, with her practice frequently interrogating language, particularly the written word, as well as dialects of domesticity, family, and the self. Catherine's first exhibition was in 1978 at Melbourne's Ewing and George Payton Gallery alongside Helen Frankenthaler, and she has exhibited regularly ever since. Catherine has an honours degree from the University of Melbourne in literature and political science, which remains focuses and drives in her work. She holds a master's from VCA and a PhD from Deakin University. Catherine's work is held in most of Australia's major public collections, including those of the National Gallery of Australia, National Gallery of Victoria, Queensland Art Gallery, Ballarat Art Gallery. The list goes on. Hello, Catherine and Jazz. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
It's so lovely to have you both here. Thank you so much for doing this with us. I'd love to begin by talking about each of your practices and unpacking how you each use words and language. Can we start with you, Jazz? Can you give us a little rundown of how this influences your work?
Yeah. I think every part of my practice, which can be a bit sprawling at times, is somehow centered in language and poetics. But really thinking about story and the stories that country teaches and the stories that we inherit through the various strains of history that we are a part of, and using those forms to think about our contemporary moment and the way that we make sense of that. So I use poetics as someone who publishes poetry, but also in visual art, trying to integrate story, sound, text, visuals, however it can be configured. I want to invite audiences to sort of being inside a poem as best I can. And I also make films, so that's very much a form of language, in whichever way you sort of consider it, visually or kind of orally or in the narrative form. So, yeah, language is really at the core of everything I do. But I think it's also the way that I think about being human. Language is sort of at the core of everything we do. I think we are creatures that are connected through story and through language. And so that's how it makes sense to me to orient.
And Catherine, your work is much more visual than jazz's in a way. Although jazz, I do want to come back to how you visually present words on your pages. That is always something that fascinates me within your poetry. But Catherine, how do you think words influence your visual practice?
Well, I think it is right that my practice is visual, but words, like a part of my thinking in when I'm beginning a picture. And also, I think in general, I would say that I have a vocabulary. I have like a vocabulary of images, and I have like an alphabet of images. They're things where I build up. I have like lots of images. I've got boxes full of images of that I have to, that I use or don't, you know, change. And it's actually like I just added like the last few days the magpie. So I just, like, something comes in like that, like in the swan, or things which where I think of those as images but also like vocabulary. Like, so I remember Drusilla Majeska, the writer, wrote a very good essay for me called The Vocabulary of Chairs, and that was when that's what I was doing. But it's like it just is like another way, another vocabulary, I think, but another, it's like a visual one. But yeah, so, and then I do actually also use words. I mean, I use them in the terms of using the book pages where and book spines of there of books that I most pretty much have read, and not always. There's sometimes things where I like the title and I'm never going to read the book. But I also do like including text mostly at the bottom of the, and I'm actually quite like, I don't like it to be didactic. I like it to be kind of lighter than that, but also not in, it means something to me. I've always wanted to connect literature and visual art, and I think it's great that, you know, we've, in different ways in different generations, we're doing that, because it's nearly always been film and visual art that have been rather than books. But, that's kind of me, really, both those things. And it actually goes back to my mother, a great reader, and my father, like a painter. So those two things I connect, you know, back.
I think it's really interesting with both of your practices to draw them together, and it sort of alludes to this wider conversation around literature and art and the ways in which they collide and in the ways in which they set apart. For me, jazz, when I'm consuming your words, as I touched on before, that you have this lovely ability and sort of methodology, I guess, in your practice where you place words on the page. And for me as a reader, when I'm reading your words, it kind of changes the way that I hear them in my mind. And I assume that this is sort of underpins some of the reasoning behind why you do this. It allows me to take breaks and it adds to this sort of visuality of the words on the page for me. But Catherine, I guess yours are a little bit different, because when I see your paintings, your words jump out in a way that sort of allows me to read the work in a more visual way.
For me, it does. I want the words to be, like, I don't want them to be like didactic, but I do want them to kind of somehow illuminate what, like, add to what I'm trying to say in the picture. So yeah, I do want that. And it's actually kind of fun being able to use words too. And I love the way you place them on the page, Jazz. It is an important part of it.
Yeah, yeah. Jazz, could you talk a little bit more about the decision-making there?
There's a few things at play, right? Like, I really am quite a visual person, and so making the most of the page, like, is quite fun and intriguing. And to me, when I was sort of first laying out how to make a basket and thinking about what it is to make a book, and a book is sort of something that you hope people will take into their home, and I wanted that to be a precious thing. I wanted it to feel like something special that you couldn't have in another way. And so having a book that was really playing with form and playing with the tactility of the text was really fun. So the fact that in How to Make a Basket, you sort of can turn the book around and change it, and the way that you read it affects the way that you understand the text is I think a really lovely invitation to a reader. But also, I'm really, really bad with grammar. Like, I don't really know how you're meant to use colons and commas and full stops properly. So for me, using the space of the page actually tells the reader the amount of breath that is meant to be there and the amount of pause. And to me, that feels so much more natural for the orality of language than to actually use the standard forms of English grammar, which I find to be a bit harsh or a bit like not generous.
Do you think that ideas around Western forms of word making play into this for you, Jazz? I'd love to discuss how you kind of break these rules in a way and bring in both English and often Wiradjuri words within your works.
It's such an incredible legacy to be someone who is a Wiradjuri person and hence connected to the Wiradjuri language, because it is a language of so much beauty and so much poetics and so much truth. You know, I feel like English so often fails to capture the richness and the truth of things, particularly of this place as someone of this continent. The first languages of this continent are the true languages, and they speak a language the country can hear. And so for me to be able to work into Wiradjuri is, it just makes sense, right? Because it is such a beautiful language, and I'm not a fluent Wiradjuri speaker, but I'm a Wiradjuri learner. And the best way for me to integrate my learnings is to work with the language and speak the language as best I can. And so that really drives a lot of my interest in working and speaking and playing with Wiradjuri. And also to challenge English. I think because we are so inundated with English in this continent, I think sometimes people forget that it is not the language of this place. And so I see part of my responsibility as someone who works with language is to challenge that dominance and to get people to question the languages that they know and the ways that they relate to the first languages here. But it's just a gift. Wiradjuri is so beautiful. I feel so lucky that I get to speak and learn and be a part of this language, because it teaches me so much about the world, and it invites me into philosophies through language that are not available to me through English.
Mm. I love certain parts of your first book, How to Make a Basket, when you dive into these words that have multiple meanings in Wiradjuri language. I remember one of them which sort of struck a chord with me, the many meanings for billabong. Can you talk to this?
Yeah, so billabong, the word that we all know that's sort of been anglicised, is a Wiradjuri word, originally billabong. And billa is our word for a river, and billabong is a part of the river's flow that's been cut off to make a small pool. So the way that we understand the word in English. But billabong also means the Milky Way night sky. So it means the universe, and it also means a pool of water. And I think that interplay between life-giving structures is so elegantly held in those shared meanings.
Mm, absolutely. It's so beautiful. Catherine, how do you choose the words that you incorporate into your paintings and your works?
I've just been thinking about like a very specific thing, which is about when Jazz is saying it's not the language of this country, and it's also, I think it's like, it connects with the fact that we live in a patriarchal, and there's patriarchal language, which is like what you're getting at is something that's not that. And the, if you think of names I have just reread Griselda Pollock's book to do with the whole thing of how women became eliminated from and also Indigenous, everything other than white male was. And she describes it as being like it wasn't something where people wanted to, they weren't consciously eliminating, but actually what happened was that the structure of art history is patriarchal. It's like it actually is a kind of, it's within the discipline. And so, I mean, there were women painting and, you know, there were lots of paintings and things, but just not rated. Once in the 19th and 20th century, when art history became a discipline, it actually went backwards. So that's, I'm very conscious of that could happen again. And I'm thinking of with the names, it's like, it happens to, particularly to women artists, is where there's a choice, like that she describes how when they did the retrospective of Artemisa Gentileschi, it was called Artemisa, and they would not do that of a male artist. It would not be just the first name. And so it's a kind of infantilizing thing where it should be, it always needs to be both names. So just, I think the thing that I'm trying to do is, I'm aware of all of that, but I don't want it to be like I'm being now, like this heavy-handed thing. But it is something about the names. I have done whole pictures all about the names, and it's very important to, yeah, that's a conscious thing. I mean, so I use language in several different ways. That's one way I have done it, where it is like getting people to name women artists.
Reinserting their names. So you're talking almost about erasure, right? And erasure.
Absolute erasure, which was by the nature of what the discipline was, which was to say, this is what a great work is, and it needs to be transcendent. It needs to not be about daily things. It needs to be all of that. Like, and in the effect was to eliminate, was to erase women.
This linguicide, really, and that's...
Absolutely, yeah.
It's so connected to works by First Nations artists too, Jazz, right? Linguicide of language.
Yeah, and I'm conscious of keeping all First Nations, but I think the danger is for women to be... I think that's the... That's the risky thing of something where it can slip back. It can go back to that. So I'm feeling like quite strongly feminist at the, you know, I think it needs to be remembered. Like, look what's happening in America. They're talking about, you know, I mean, with all the stuff about controlling women's bodies, it's like, it's that stuff does not necessarily just go get better and better. Doesn't necessarily do that. So I think with language, I feel that stuff, but I don't want to have it come across like that in a picture. It needs to be more like somehow transcended in the work. I think it comes out in some more playful way, but not lose its... So I had thought of doing like you could do a whole list of male artists just by their first names. I mean, that just would not... No one does that. That does not happen. So...
Do you think that using language within your work, and this is sort of a question to both of you really, do you think it's a political act?
I kind of do, but do you, yeah. Do you, Jess?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think personally everything that I do as an art maker or not, like as a queer Indigenous woman, it is all a political act, really. Like the survival in a colony that wants to erase the existence of multiple communities that I'm a part of, to even like speak or thrive is a political act. And so I think coming back to that idea of like English is a language that is so full of dominance and hierarchy and violence and extraction. Like it has these sort of forms that we don't need, but because we live in a society that is structured in English, it's really hard to disentangle like capitalism and patriarchy because it's actually the foundation of the way that we communicate. So like any opportunity to sort of challenge that and to center country or community or story or connection to me is quite political. To even center love is a political thing because it shows that we are loving, joyous people in a society that has always wanted to render the Indigenous body or the queer body as a site of violence and violence only. So, yeah, that's... I think I'm kind of to quote Richard Bell, like an activist masquerading as an artist, I think most blackfellas are.
Let's talk about names, shall we? You were touching on female names there, Catherine in particular. Can I ask where each of you got your names from?
Mine's a very straight, white, Aussie way of where I got, well, so kind of. I mean, I was the first child and first daughter, and so I was given my, I'm Catherine Helen Joanna, so I was given my mother, her mother, her sister, I mean, her twin, so I got all of the names. So, and then I had two other sisters afterwards, and they got other people's names, but it was like, I mean, they got other family names, but yeah, but also as a woman, I did not get my mother's maiden name. I did not get, and you know, so it was like, I wish I had, and that didn't happen. I don't know. What did you, Jazz, have?
I actually took my mum's last name when I turned 19, when I was kind of legally able to. My mum's last name is Money, and it's, I know it's such a ridiculous last name, but it comes from,
that's great, the,
it was originally a French last name. It's the same as Monet, and apparently some, you know, French family moved over to the UK and they anglicised it and turned it into Money, which is, you know, quite ridiculous, really. But that's where my last name comes from. And then my first name, Jazz, was just, my parents are kind of eccentric or kind of cute, and they thought that would be a great name in the early 90s. So I ended up with this, like, quite outrageous name. I sometimes wish I'd taken
Jazz
a pen
Money.
Name just so that people
Absolutely.
Would stop assuming that I have a really funny pen name. But, yeah, it's a relatively straightforward story.
Catherine, do you feel the sense of responsibility having ancestral names within your own?
In relation to names, I have this. This is a bit at a tangent, but because I did this project where and it was to do with it's to do with women artists, where I asked people to name three favourite women artists, like alive or dead, Australian or international, and then I kind of colour-coded them and made this work, which is actually in the Art Gallery of South Australia, and which is bring out the names of women who were... Lots of people could not name three women artists. So, and that another iteration of that was in Melbourne Now, which is like a list of women artists, and actually it was hanging in the Joseph Brown collection, and all went men in that, the 50s of that, and someone said to me that nearly all of those male artists had wives who painted. Mm. That was in response to the Philip Guston thing called Pantheon, which is he names his favourite artists, and they are Masaccio, Giotto, Piero Gelafrancesca, but they're all male and all a long time ago, so mine were much more contemporary. So names mean something to me. They do. They mean something political, I think. There's something quite significant in that. And people writing about art say it's, they have to make a choice. Well, they choose with women artists, like, because quite often they change their... Well, like choosing your mother's name is a fantastic thing. I regret not taking my mother's name, not including it in all those names I've got, which, and also I didn't give my sons or daughter my name. They've both each taken different fathers' names, which is, it's kind of, don't realise how much we are in a patriarchal society. We really, even if you kind of don't want to be, you can't make that. I do wish I had, but I think it is too late. I don't think you can do that now.
My middle name is Margaret, and that is also the middle name of my mother, and I think three or four women before that too. And growing up, I always really hated that, the Sophie Margaret. It sort of sounded like an old woman to me. And the women in my family were sort of complex and complicated women, extremely sort of powerful figures, but complicated in their own way, and which I'm growing up, I feel really proud to carry their narratives within my name now. And I've got my own daughter who's two, and she has my mother-in-law's maiden name as her middle name. And I've always said if I have another child, they'll have my mother's maiden name as their middle name too. And I guess this, I guess what I'm trying to say is reinserting lost female names is a wonderful thing, bringing them back. And this sort of tradition that I think that we are sort of stepping away from in women changing their names when they marry. I think,
well,
yeah.
I bet you didn't change your name, Jess.
When I got married, no, no.
See, I've changed my name twice.
Right.
It just shows, and it's ridiculous. It's like, yeah, I've changed it. Each time I've got married, I've changed it. And I actually use my father's name now, and I've seen the next generation, quite a few women are changing their names, and it's, apart from being basically a mistake, it's a nightmare in doing things. So yeah, it's like these ways names are. My whole work could be about names, but I then have a few other things that I like doing, like images. Images can be less, they can be more open, I think, in than text in some ways. It's like, yeah. I think the other thing about language is psychoanalysis is another way where words can be much less harsh and less clear, where they can have more, it can have a more mixed interpretation and more where you can say something you don't realise what you're saying, actually. It's not. So there's, yeah, I think that whole, which kind of is a different version of the indigenous way of using words, but they don't, it doesn't, it, yeah, there's language can be lots of things, I think.
I like that point that language can be lots of things, and it makes me think that using words and language within visual art and creative arts in general, it kind of allows us to have deeper conversations around the nuances of life. And I think that we're at a point in history where everything seems very black and white and polarized and sort of in conflict with each other. And I think there's a point to be made that using language within our creative arts allows us to sort of see the grays and the human experiences a little bit more. Can we talk to that? And do you agree?
Yeah, I think it's one of the great aims for me is like nuance, like rather than, but it's, yeah, and it's very difficult to kind of have that kind of conversation, I think. But I think you manage that in your poetry.
I've been thinking about this a lot lately, thinking about like what can poetry actually do? Like what actual act can it make in a world that is so complex and so fraught? And I think I've been thinking a lot about sort of ancestral inheritance and the thing that we call poetry now, you know, it isn't just words on a page, because it can't be, because, you know, poetics has existed on this place, on this continent for tens of thousands of years. It's existed here since the first sunrise. And so if you understand poetics to sort of be something that is an action, that is the way that we tell stories and therefore the way that we connect, I think that is an active thing, because the way that we connect is the way that we organize and the way that we make change. And I think in a world where things feel so desperately divided, it's through the act of telling stories and the act of connection and the act of empathy that comes through our stories and comes through our legacies that we carry, that's actually an incredibly potent thing to be doing. And so it makes me, slightly believe that these things matter, because sometimes it can feel really indulgent or really like maybe meaningless to have a creative arts practice in a world where children are dying, you know, like what are we actually doing? And I don't think that poetry is going to tear down apartheid walls, but I do think poetry is part of the way that we rebuild when we tear systems down.
I think partly if you're aiming for nuance, you're actually probably going to make it more difficult to actually achieve things. I mean, in some ways the way people achieve things is the black and white, but it's not, it's destructive. I mean, it's not necessarily... I actually really like the way you talk about this place, Jazz. It's like I feel very strongly about this place. Like, my work is definitely located in Australia and being in that Australian art history. I've grown up in that. I know a lot about it, and I, you know, first, just visually have, and also I think the fact that we're an island has been a big, you know, it really matters in the way we experience things. I think it's like it's a, so it's from a very different position from you, but it's like there is, I do think this place is a really good, I think I might call a picture that.
I'm honoured.
It's like it's not just any old place. It's like something very specific, I think, and very important. Well, and like, what you know, the indigenous heritage is a big part of it, but it's also the complex, what it is now as well.
Yeah, I think I didn't really answer your question before about nuance. I think I just went on a tangent.
Well, nuance is like you have to be able to tolerate, you have to be able to handle two different things, really, like two opposing things. You have to be able to kind of not necessarily just say, no, it's that. It's like it can be this and that, and are not necessarily like doesn't necessarily stay the same, or it's complex.
I think that's why I am drawn to a visual arts practice, because there is so much complexity and there is so much nuance in, you know, every step that we take on this continent. You know, it connects us to deep time, but it also reinforces the colonial structures that we live in. You know, we are constantly walking through these built environments that are trying to tell us one version of the story. And so for me, visual art becomes this really sort of intoxicating medium for complicating that, right? And sort of trying to draw in different parts of these threads and stories and different perspectives, and trying to say, like, how else could we read any one environment with more information or with new information? And that's sort of, for me, where language becomes a really practical tool, because you can say things directly, but you can also create enough nuance, again, to use that word, or enough intrigue, or enough opposing forces at once, that you can actually begin to say that, yeah, this thing that we're reading on the surface isn't black and white. It's you know, it's grey the whole way.
You spoke about films there, Catherine. Can we have a moment now to talk about Wenangana?
Yes, of course. And it means Wenangana. It's a Wiradjuri word. It doesn't translate super neatly into English, but many good things don't. It means to know and to think and to remember all at once, in Wiradjuri understanding. And it's a feature film that I made last year with the National Film and Sound Archive. The film is made entirely of archival footage made by or about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as held within the National Film and Sound Archive collection. And it was a real journey to try and make something that spoke about the conditions of gaze and storytelling and power brokering that happens in these sorts of collections. And I mean, anyone who has ever caught the archive fever will know what it is to be sort of sucked into these spaces. But it was incredible, but it was also really awful. I mean, the archive tells a really violent story of dispossession and myth-making. But within that, it is also a space where we have so many connections to the past, and held within these archives is the truth of our bodies and the truth of our stories and the truth of our families and kin. And I think that is something that even when people were being portrayed in compromised ways, there is still a sovereign body at the centre of these stories. And that to me was a really intriguing provocation that you know, the official archive, I think, is a very misleading, non-neutral thing, but the true archive is the body, which is testimony to survival and love and resilience and hardship as well. And so Wananganna was really a process of making a film, interrogating what an archive is and what stories are being told about this place through the archives, and the way that they actually have really tangible impacts on today. Like, I think the way that we understand, say, the referendum that happened in 2023 could be told really succinctly over 100 years of colonial myth-making in the audiovisual industry.
How do you mean? Can you say a bit more about that?
I think the way that so many people in Australia understand Australian history is something that has been fed through media and been fed through film and television and radio and literature and art, of course, by extension. But I think film and television are particular mediums that get into bedrooms and get into homes and get into conversation. And I think the way that that story has been told for generations is, you know, that my research in the archive was very much research into terra nullius and justification and erasure, that I think has fed into the zeitgeist of Australia in a way that's now really hard to entangle, and we're trying to do that now. And especially since the 70s, you can see when you're looking at the audiovisual archive, the huge influx of people telling their own stories and sovereign storytelling. But it's still in competition with an already established myth, right? And that is a really hard thing to challenge. And so I think the media and film and television have no small part to play in the sort of mess that we're in now, that we're sort of trying to untangle. And trying to use those same mediums to untangle them is, I think, part of the responsibility of those mediums, but also adds to the complexity of how messy it really all is.
Yeah, and I think it also is like what we know, like how much we don't know. And when you have, I think it's very important to have, like, archives can tell you one thing or another. I mean, it just depends. It's like, I think, information about what, like, I think I immediately relate it to the whole thing of women versus men. I mean, not, but it is like, if you're talking about a patriarchy, it is that. And if you look at, like, me deciding to be, you know, becoming, I didn't decide, I just gradually became a woman artist. If I'd known that the fact of something like, this is, I mean, it doesn't really relate directly, but it does, the National Gallery in London in 19, I think it was when they went to have a look, it was like either 1980s or 70s, they had 9 works by women that they'd collected over 500 years. So there's a message in that, which is like this, there's a kind of force, it's power, deciding not to do that. So it's where, it's like something like a National Gallery is an archive. It is like, it has, you know, what people have thought was important. And apparently those 9 pictures were all in the basement too. None of them were on the walls. And it's like, I think now there's probably 12. I mean, it's Artemisia Gentileschi's picture was bought in whenever date it was, like just not that long ago. It was the 20th picture that's been bought by the National Gallery in London in however many hundred years. It's like, you know, there's this huge force against what you think should be, I mean, we're 50% of the population. It's like, so it's like a thing where we need, the archive is very important in telling what's really kind of going on or has gone on, I think.
Yeah, I think the archive isn't a reliable witness to the truth, but it is a reliable witness to power broking, right? And who had the story, who had the power to tell the story at any given moment. And that, you know, those histories of collection are exactly that. You know, who had the power to be making those collections and what narrative were they reinforcing by doing so? And I think that's a fascinating way to read history, right? Because the moment that you identify who holds power, you then wonder who was denied the power. And like you're saying, Catherine, these collections and archives really, the absence is where you can find some of the most interesting stories.
And in those collections, Indigenous art would have been considered like ethnographic. That was the only interest, like not fine art. It's like that, and that has, you know, gradually changed, or it has changed. But yeah, if you looked at that, there would be like none in those collections. I think it's a great idea to have made a film. It's a brilliant idea to through the archive. It's very, yeah.
It was a really fascinating process. It was quite a hard one. But because I guess I have a background as a filmmaker, I sort of feel quite comfortable in that space. And
I'd love to know where audiences can see Wenangana.
So Wenangana is still in the system of touring in festivals and whatnot. It's quite a, for someone who writes poetry, it's a very, very different world. You know, you write a book and you hope that it gets into as many people's hands kind of as quickly as it can. With a film, it's touring and it's reaching audiences in different ways, and we'll eventually have a broadcast partnership. So it will eventually be able to, you know, watch at home and stream at home, but that's, you know, it has to happen in a certain order of things.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, look, maybe we can organise a screening at the NGV.
That will reach huge audiences, I would imagine. A film does, doesn't it, really, on the whole?
Yeah, it does, and it generates conversation in such an interesting way, you know, because it's very immediate. People watch something and they formulate their thoughts immediately. Something that I was going to say before, which I was just going to say, that my experience of, you know, making Wenangana really felt like writing poetry a lot of the time, because it was such an intuitive process. And I find film editing is really similar to writing poetry, for me at least, because it's all about taking imagery and pairing it together in new ways to say something, to create information in that third space. And that's, you know, complementing images coming together, or contrasting images, and the way that you layer them and the way that you thread them together creates the narrative. And so I found that process to be something that was very familiar, even though it was a medium that seems, they seem like quite different mediums. I think there is a lot of synchronicity between them.
Catherine and Jazz, thank you so much for coming on this podcast today. You've both got really exciting things coming up later in the year. I believe your work is appearing in Dialogue in a group exhibition at Hayden's, Who Cares? Radical Generosity. I'm looking forward to that. And of course, Jazz, we are all eagerly awaiting your second poetry collection, Mark the Dawn. I cannot wait to devour that as I did the first one. Thank you both again. This was so wonderful. And I look forward to seeing what comes later in the year. Thank
you both. Look forward to hearing this.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on this episode. I would like to acknowledge that this conversation took place on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country. We pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are listening, as well as the elders past, present and emerging. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.